Okay. Can you hear me in the back? Maybe. Okay, thanks. All right, thank you. I appreciate the chance to give a talk today. Mine is sort of, I guess, the next in this sort of series of introduction talks. So my goal is going to be to give you sort of a broad overview of the theory of quantum communications. Specifically, I want to tell you about the capacities of a quantum channel for transmitting various different types of information. And I don't know, you should feel free to ask questions and stuff, because I guess that's kind of the point. Okay. So the theory of information and communication goes back a pretty long way. But the person who really set off the modern study of information theory, I think, was Shannon in 1948. And Shannon really sort of emphasized the statistics of messages. And he made a lot of progress understanding things by thinking of messages and noise processes as being drawn from some probability distribution. Okay? So this quote sort of from that original paper, I think, does a good job of summarizing the kinds of questions and, people think of generally as information theory. So this is sort of broad enough to encompass a source coding or data compression, channel coding or error correction, signal detection, cryptography, and many other things. Okay, and we're sort of going to be focusing on this channel coding problem today. It's I wanted to get it to go on two slides. Okay. Anyway, the sort of the general problem that we're going to be interested in today is a model of sort of many engineering systems. So the idea is you have some communication channel that you'd like to use to transmit information. You have some input alphabet, X, and you stick it into the channel, and the channel does something noisy. It adds some sort of corruption, or it loses bits, or something like that. And the output of the channel is this variable Y. And we can sort of describe entirely our channel in terms of these transition probabilities, the probability of a Y coming out given that the input was X. Okay. And our goal is, I mean, well, our goal will be, you know, if you have access to a large number of independent uses of this channel, all right, our goal will be to figure out a way that a sender who has some message that she'd like to transmit, M, can encode that message into the input alphabets of all of the different channel uses in such a way that the receiver, who gets the outputs of all the channels, Y1 up to Yn, can do some decoding operation and get out a reasonable approximation of M. So our goal is to find sort of an encoder and decoding scheme that allows us that allows for the receiver to figure out M prime in such a way that it's almost always equal to M. Okay, and of course we'd like to do this for the largest number of messages possible. Okay. All right. So this sort of defines the game that we're interested in, which is to characterize the capacity of a channel, N, which is defined as follows. It's just the total number of bits that you can transmit per channel use in the limit of many channel uses, where you require that the probability of error, or the probability of there being an error on any of the transmitted bits, goes to zero in the asymptotic limit, right? Okay, so there's sort of two steps that you would like if you're really thinking of using this in practice. You'd like first, in terms of these parameters of your channel, the transition probabilities, to understand what is the capacity just as a function of these transmission probabilities. All right, and once you've done that, your sort of work's not over, because you've also got to find some sort of practical constructions for approaching the capacity. Usually, in order to characterize the capacity, we get some sort of non-constructive proof that a code exists that might help us. Okay. So while these are both very interesting questions, you kind of need to do the first before you can do the second. And at least in the quantum case, we're still working pretty hard on the first goal. And so I guess for the rest of the talk, I'll be mostly focusing on this. Although sort of classically, I would say maybe in the last 15 years, this second part has really become, well, solved to a great extent for many channels that we care about. Okay, so this is sort of an outline for the rest of the talk. First, I want to just tell you about the sort of classical coding theorem. Just tell you about the capacity of a classical channel for transmitting classical information. And that I'm going to try to sketch the proof pretty thoroughly. But what we're really interested in are quantum channels and their capacities. Okay, so then I'll remind you sort of what quantum states and channels are, mainly to just introduce notations, because we've seen a lot of this already in the last couple of days. And then I'll state and sketch the proofs of sort of three quantum coding theorems. Okay, there are three in this case because there are different types of information we might want to transmit. So specifically, I'll tell you about the capacity of a quantum channel for transmitting classical information, that's secret. So secret from some eavesdropper. Specifically, our channels are going to have some environments, and we'd like to make sure that the environments don't learn anything about the messages sent. And finally, I'll tell you about the capacity of a quantum channel for transmitting quantum information. Okay. And in all of these cases, we'll get coding theorems, we'll get sort of some achievable rates, but we won't get a nice characterization of what the capacity is. And this is related to sort of questions of additivity, all right? And I guess for the rest of the day, most of the talks will be about capacities. So for example, this questions of additivity stuff relates closely to the talk that Chris King will give later, I think. Okay. Okay, so this is we're going to try to understand the capacity of a classical channel for transmitting classical information. And to do that, we need a little bit of machinery. We just need to define a few things. Specifically, we need to understand typical sequences. Okay, so let's say I have n independent and identically distributed random variables, and let's make them just be binary random variables for now. And let's suppose the probability that X, our variable, is equal to 1 is P, and the probability that it's equal to 0 is 1 minus P. Okay, so if we look at this sort of string of n x's, and n is reasonably large, then actually with high probability, it's going to have the right shape, right? It's going to have roughly P times n 1s and 1 minus n times P, 1 minus P times n zeros. All right? So we call the strings that sort of look like they came from the right distribution or have the right weights typical sequences. Okay, and how many different typical sequences are there? There are something like n choose p times n typical sequences, right? And does anybody know how I could do n choose k in PowerPoint? I worked pretty hard on this one, and I couldn't.
That's why we
didn't see
it.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. And anyway, the total number of typical sequences, if our random variable has sort of probability of being 1 of p, is just something like 2 to the n times the binary entropy of p. So the binary entropy is just defined as this minus log, or minus p times log p minus 1 times log minus 1. More generally, it's this. Right? So if I have some non-binary distribution, the entropy is just given by this. And of course, in that case, you can do a similar thing, right? With high probability, if I have a large number of instances of IID random variables, the string looks sort of like you'd expect. It has the right fraction of ones, twos, threes, and fours. Okay. So now there's one more piece that we kind of have to understand before we can understand the capacity, the classical capacity. These are called conditionally typical sequences. All right. So now instead of just a bunch of IID random variables, I have a bunch of pairs of random variables. So x1 and x2 are correlated in some way, but each pair is chosen independently and with the same distribution. Okay, so then let's say I tell you the string of x's. We'd like to know if if for a typical string of x's, there's some high probability set that these y's almost certainly live in, right? And of course, well, such a thing exists, and these are called conditionally typical, right? These are just the sets that, you know, given what you know about x, have the right sort of fraction of different letters in y to be consistent with the conditional probability distributions. Okay, and the total number of conditionally typical sets, conditionally typical y's, if we have some joint distribution on x and y, is just something like 2 to the n times the conditional entropy of y given x. And this conditional entropy of y given x, you can write it in two ways. It's either just the average over x of the entropy of the sort of conditional entropy of y given a particular value of x, or it's just this difference between the joint entropy of y and x and the total entropy of x. Okay, and now this is just to remind you what our game was, right? What we have a bunch of different, a bunch of independent channels, n, and we want to find some way to encode our message m into the inputs of our channel in such a way that at the output, the receiver can sort of distinguish all the different m's that we tried to encode, right? And we're going to use these conditionally typical and typical sequences. Okay, so first let me just state the result. I don't know, is it annoying when the sort of the most beautiful theorem in a field is proven in the first paper in the field? In any case, this comes straight out of Shannon's original paper. Let's say we have some channel N, and it has some transition probabilities, P of y given x. Okay, and the capacity of n, remember, is a sort of maximum number of bits per channel use that we can send given a large number of uses. So this is somehow a very operational and actually pretty nasty characterization of what we're looking for, right? We'd like some compact expression that tells us what this optimal rate is. And that's exactly what Shannon's theorem will give us. It just tells us that the capacity of our channel is exactly equal to the maximum over all distributions on the input variables of the mutual information between the input and the output. And then this mutual information is just defined in two ways. It's either the entropy of y minus the entropy of y given x, or it's just the difference between the sum of the individual entropies and the joint entropy. Okay, so now we want to prove this. So what are we going to do? We're going to pick our code words from the set of typical x's, where x is this input distribution. Okay, so I'm going to add one. And for this code word, there's a set of conditionally typical y's that lives in the set of typical y's over here. Okay, and just keep an eye on what these sizes are. So there's something like 2 to the n entropy of y typical y's, and this conditionally typical space is something like 2 to the n entropy of y given x, right? So I'm going to keep adding x's from the typical space until I've just about filled up this entire space of typical y's, okay? And then you can pretty easily figure out exactly how many x's you're likely to be able to add there. And the answer is, well, it's the total number of typical y's divided by the size of the set I keep adding every time I pick a typical x, right? So it's 2 to the n h of y over to the n h of y given x. Okay, so that's what tells us that sort of the number of typical exos that we'll be able to add is something like 2 to the n entropy, or 2 to the n mutual information between x and y. Okay, so that shows us that basically for any rate that's at least that's sort of less than this maximum this maximum mutual information, we can actually achieve that rate. And now we'd like to show that this is optimal, right? So for any rate bigger than this maximum mutual information, we can't transmit with high fidelity at that rate. Okay, so there are two steps in proving this classical converse. The first is to show that this classical capacity is no bigger than the following. And now instead of having a single use of the channel, I take many uses of the channel. I take an arbitrary random variable on the input spaces of all those channels, and I look at the output of those n channels, and then I evaluate the mutual information. And I divide that by the total number of channel uses, and I let the number of channel uses go to infinity. That you can show is an upper bound for the classical capacity, right? So that's sort of step one you usually take, and step two is to show that in fact this quantity is additive, that the maximum, evaluating the maximum over many channel uses is actually not necessary. The maximum is achieved for independent inputs to various uses of the channel. Okay. So step one involves sort of arguing about the continuity of entropies, and that's related to the talk that Debbie is going to give next. And step two, this is about additivity. And the bad news is, or the good news, I don't know. The bad news is it fails for most quantum cases. So for example, see Chris King's talk or Professor Collins, and also Toby Cubitt's talk. They're all sort of talking about different aspects of additivity questions. Okay, so now, quantum states and channels. This will be easy. Well, pure states are just elements of this d-dimensional complex vector space. A mixed state, because I'm going to be using finite dimensions, is just a bounded linear operator. It's positive. It should have trace 1. And in general, I can write my mixed state as a mixture over different pure states. Okay? The quantum channels, these are just the things that map quantum states to quantum states. So they're the completely positive trace preserving maps. They have this, you can write the action of some quantum channel as either a mixture over conjugations by these Krauss operators, or you can think of them as having some isometric extension. So I conjugate the input state by some isometry that maps from the input space to a bipartite space B and E, and then I trace out E. Okay, so E is like the environment of our channel. Okay, one more bit of background, and then we get to think about quantum capacities. So remember, if I have some mixed state, it's going to be I can write it as a pure state followed by a partial trace. And the entropy of some mixed state is just defined by minus trace rho log rho. Okay? And somehow it measures the amount of uncertainty in B. And it tells us also how much information there is in B that we have to sort of, well, it tells us, for example, if I have a large number of copies of our state, psi AB, and I want to compress the B systems down as much as possible, it tells us actually we can't go any more than 2 to the n times the entropies. Okay, so if I have some pure state, there's some typical space that has dimension something like 2 to the n entropy of B that somehow holds all of the weight of this mixed state rho B. And this is sort of analogous to these typical spaces that we were talking, these typical sequences we were talking about in the classical case. Okay, now we're going to move on to the quantum coding theorems. So like I said before, there are sort of different kinds of information that you might want to send with a quantum channel. So the first kind, and probably the one that relates most closely to what we just talked about, is the classical capacity. So if you want to send classical information from your sender to your receiver, you're interested in the classical capacity. The second kind, which is related to sort of quantum cryptography, is the private classical capacity. And the idea there is that you'd like to send some classical information, but furthermore, if some adversary is holding on to all of the environments of the channels that you're using, right? You remember this this isometric extension of a channel to B and E. If some adversary is holding on to all of the E's, you'd like to make sure that she can't learn anything about the classical messages that you send. Okay? And finally, you might be interested in sending quantum information. You might want to be able to transmit an arbitrary quantum state on some subspace. And that leads to the classical capacity. And actually, there's even more than three. There are many, because I might give you sort of various resources that will help you in what you're trying to do. So I could give you free entanglement. I could give you two-way classical communication. I could give you all sorts of things. Okay, so there are many, many capacities. Okay, so this is just a statement of the problem that we're trying to solve now for the classical capacity. So we have some channel N. It maps from some system A prime to B. And we want to find some code that maps the, that maps the numbers 1 to M to some inputs to N copies of our quantum channel. Okay? And of course, what we want to do is to make log of m as large as possible. That's the total number of bits we send. But we have this constraint that when the channel acts on these different messages, the resulting states should all be distinguishable, right? So what we're trying to do is make m as big as possible, subject to the constraint that these guys are all approximately orthogonal. Okay, and this is how we're going to do it. You have your channel that maps A prime to B. You imagine you have some classical random variable X. It's associated with some probabilities P sub X. And you have some set of inputs to the channel, phi sub X. Right? We call the pair of a random variable X and an associated set of quantum states and ensemble. Okay? And we define chi of N and the ensemble to just be the mutual information between that classical variable and the output of the channel. Okay? So that's mutual information evaluated on this state on XB. And it turns out, basically, by a sort of a random coding argument, that this chi of NE is achievable. And I think I have a sketch of that next. Good. All right, so this is actually a lot like what we did before. In the classical case, we have these typical X's here. Now we have a typical space of the output that has size 2 to the n times entropy of B, where that entropy is actually evaluated on the state rho. Okay? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a state. I'm going to randomly pick a typical X. And the image, the sort of the conditionally typical image of that X under the action of the channel takes up, again, a space of dimension roughly 2 to the n conditional entropy of B given X, right? So what I do is I keep adding these things until I'm pretty likely to just barely fill up the whole space. All right, so you keep adding typical X's until their image is just a bit smaller than the total size of this space here, and you can do the division, and this tells us that, you know, probably we're going to be okay as long as we keep the rate, or we keep the number of X's less than this. All right, so this sort of argues that that this mutual information between X and B is achievable. Sorry, dropped it. Okay, so that's sort of where the similarities end, because what you'd like, well, okay, so we saw that this chi of N and any ensemble is achievable. So if we let just chi of the channel be equal to the maximum over all ensembles of this chi of N and the ensemble, well, that's also achievable. It just says, you know, pick the best ensemble you can think of. And in fact, if I take N copies of the channel and divide that by divide chi of that bigger channel by N, it's also achievable, right? I just think of this N copies of my channel as being a bigger channel on which I apply this achievability theorem. Okay, so in fact, the classical capacity we can show is equal to just this limit over n of 1 over n times chi of n, n times the channel, okay? And we usually call this a regularization, right? And the good news is there are some channels for which the capacity is just equal to this chi of n. But then there are other channels for which it's not true, okay? So the subject, I mean, the additivity of this chi thing is the subject of Chris's talk later. Okay, and even better than this, the fact that there are some channels for which the capacity is equal to this chi just tells us that if you try to transmit at any rate beyond that, the sort of fidelity that you get can't approach 1, right? You can't have an arbitrarily small probability of failure. But actually, you can do better than that. There are some channels for which if you try to transmit at a rate beyond this chi, in fact, your fidelity will be exponentially bad, or your probability of error will be arbitrarily close to 1. And that's the subject of Stephanie's talk. Okay, I just want to state this result for private classical information. If, remember now we had this channel N, and it has some isometric extension that maps from the input space A to B and E. If we let N prime just be the sort of channel that you get by, instead of tracing out E, tracing out B, you get the picture that you get the channel from the input to the environment of the channel rather than the input to the output of the channel. And we want to send classical information to the output of the channel in such a way that the environment actually learns nothing about the message. Okay? So if we let P1 of the channel just be the maximum over all ensembles of this chi of N of ensemble of the ensemble minus chi of N prime of the ensemble, then it turns out that this P1 is achievable. And the intuition for this is that this is something like how much classical information the output of the channel you can transmit to the output of the channel. This is how much classical information you can transmit to the environment of the channel. And the difference is the amount that you can transmit to the output of the channel in a way that the environment can't learn it. Okay. And like the classical capacity, this private information, P1, actually, when regularized, gives you the private classical capacity of your channel. And there are channels for which the private capacity is exactly equal to this P1. But even for qubit channels, there are instances where the private capacity is not equal to this P1. So private capacity is strictly larger, or this regularization is needed. And in fact, you can make that difference very large. Okay, so now this is our sort of this is our last coding theorem. Remember we have this channel N, again, it maps from A prime to B. And we want to find now a subspace. We're going to try to transmit quantum information. So we want a subspace of all the inputs of the channel N, of N copies of the channel, and a decoding operation, D, so that when we compose the decoding operation and N uses of the channel, we get a pretty good approximation to the identity map on this space that we're interested in. Okay. And log of the dimension of the space will be the number of qubits that we manage to send. Okay, and the coding theorem looks a little bit like this. This N should actually be N copies of it. And the idea is we have some code C. It has dimension, we're going to pick the dimension in such a way, here's what happens. We have this code C. It gets acted on by N copies of this channel. And you remember that there's this Krauss operator representation of the channel. So for each of the different Krauss operators, this C gets mapped to a sort of a different image of C. It gets conjugated by a different value of A. And the total number of sort of typical Krauss operators is like 2 to the n entropy of the environment, right? Because remember, when you trace out the environment, the different orthogonal states of the environment sort of tell you different Krauss operators, all right? So the total number of typical Krauss operators is like 2 to the n entropy of E. All right, so that's how many different copies of the space we get running around. What does it live in? It lives in this space of typical dimension 2 to the n entropy of B. Okay, so our goal is, of course, to make sure that these guys don't overlap too much. Make sure that if they don't overlap in this space, in fact, it'll be possible to do some sort of to rotate this back to get some copy of C, or well, basically to recover C and then have a bunch of other information that we decouple from C that just tells us which cross operator happened. Okay. And of course, if we want to make sure that that overlap doesn't happen, we just have to make sure that the dimension of our code satisfies this. The dimension of the code times the number of different copies of the code shouldn't be any bigger than the total dimension of the space they're getting mapped to. Okay. So that means actually we can achieve the rate entropy of B minus entropy of E for an arbitrary sort of input state to the channel. Okay. And in fact, you know, the story is very similar. You remember we have, let's see, we define this Q1 to be just the maximum over input states to the channel of the difference between the entropy of B and the entropy of E, where these entropies are you can think of them as being just evaluated on channel N and N prime, respectively. And then when you do this regularization, it turns out that you get exactly the quantum capacity. You can't do any better than this regularization. And again, there are some channels with the capacity equal to this Q1, but there are other channels for which they're very different. Okay. And in fact, there's a talk later. You don't necessarily need to know exactly what the channel is to be able to achieve this rate, and that's the subject of a talk, I think, not today, but tomorrow. Okay, and I want to show you one further capacity that's actually, as far as I know, the only one that we actually know the answer to completely. Let's say I give you not only access to a channel, but also I'll let you use an arbitrary entangled state between the sender and receiver. Okay? So the first thing to notice is that if you just have states between the sender and receiver, it's not any good for communication, right? This is just no signaling, right? So the channel the channel is somehow going to be responsible for all of the communication we can achieve. But somehow allowing this extra entanglement or this extra assistance makes the problem significantly easier, because in this setting, actually, the classical capacity of the channel assisted by entanglement, the CE of N, is just equal to the maximum mutual information remember the channel has input A prime and maps it to B. What we're going to do is we're going to have some state rho A prime act on A prime with the channel and evaluate the mutual information of that. So it turns out that that's achievable, and furthermore, it's additive. So this is sort of a compact expression for this entanglement assisted capacity. Okay, and now in the last few minutes, I just want to tell you a little bit about how these additivity questions, how additivity questions are constantly popping up in the study of these capacities. So I just want to remind you, a function on channels is additive if the function on the tensor product is equal to the sum of the values of the function on the individual channels. Okay. And there are sort of two different flavors of additivity that you might find. The first is additivity of some information measure. Okay, so that's on the right-hand side here. And when this happens, it means that this regularization that we needed in those capacity formulas actually becomes unnecessary. Okay, so let me give you some examples. For example, if we're interested in the classical the second sort of the rows are labeled by the different types of information you might be able you might be interested in transmitting or maybe the different settings in which you might be trying to operate. Okay, so if we're interested in transmitting classical information, and we're interested in looking at the additivity of information measures, then the correct information measure to look at is this Holovo information, this chi. And additivity of that chi would have given us sort of a nice compact expression for the capacity of a quantum channel for transmitting classical information. Okay, and sort of conversely, the fact that it's not additive puts us in kind of a difficult situation if we're trying to evaluate the classical capacity of a classical channel, because we don't have any kind of compact expression. Similarly, this coherent information that I introduced, this Q1, is also it seems to be the right measure of quantum information in some sense, because it's achievable. We can show it's achievable by random coding, but the fact that it's not additive, in fact, makes things tough for us. It means that we can't get a reasonable expression, or we don't seem to be able to get a reasonable expression for the quantum capacity of a chip. Okay, and similarly here. In an entanglement-assisted case, the fact that this unrestricted mutual information is additive gives us a simple expression for the entanglement-assisted quantum capacity. Okay, but there's a second kind of capacity question, second kind of additivity question that doesn't concern measures of information so much as it concerns the capacities themselves. Okay, so you remember we had some expression for the capacity of, say, the classical capacity of a quantum channel in terms of the regularization of this chi, right, this Holoovo information. But after you regularize, even though chi is not additive, it may happen that that regularized quantity becomes additive. Okay, and if that's the case, it means that somehow the capacity of the channel sort of uniquely quantifies the communication capability that you're interested in. It means, and conversely, if it's not the case, it means you have to if you want to know how useful your channel is for transmitting a particular kind of information, you really need to know what other channels are available to combine with it. Right? So for example, the quantum capacity you can show, not only is the coherent information not additive, but the capacity itself is not additive. So you can find these channels where the quantum capacity of the channel of one of them is zero, and of the other is zero. So neither is very useful for transmitting quantum information. But when you take the joint capacity, it's actually rather large. And you can find similar examples for the private classical capacity. But as far as we know, actually, the classical capacity, well, we don't know. We don't know whether the classical capacity of a quantum channel is additive or not. Okay, so it seems like, you know, most natural information measures and capacities are non-additive. There are actually non-trivial examples of channels where additivity holds, and of course we want more. And I think, you know, if you're a mathematician and you don't know that much about sort of these cats and bras and you want to do something that's somehow related to quantum information, I would say that the best thing to do is to sort of look at some of these quantities and try to figure out some cases where they become additive. So, you know, it's kind of fun to just write down what you would need for additivity and try to figure out a channel that might actually satisfy that property. So here are the channels. I think that there may be a few more, but these are the ones that I'm aware of. That satisfy sort of nice additivity, well, that behave nicely in some ways. So, for example, entanglement-breaking channels. If a channel is entanglement-breaking and some other channel is arbitrary, in fact, chi of that the entanglement-breaking channel tensor anything is additive. All right, and even better, the classical capacity of entanglement-breaking channels with something else is additive, basically because of this. Okay. There's another type of channel that I really like called degradable. These are channels where if I give you the output of the channel, you can do some further processing and generate the environment of the channel. Okay? In that case, coherent information is additive. And any two channels like that have additive capacities. And in fact, they have a nice property too, that the private capacity is equal to the quantum capacity for degradable channels. And this is actually... this means that they give good examples of additive channels with private capacity too, and some more examples of channels that behave nicely in terms of additivity are unital qubit channels, the polarizing channels, bosonic Gaussian channels, and some others. Okay, so this is my final slide. It's a list of things I didn't mention. or I will now mention. Okay. So one thing I didn't mention was that often we might be interested in situations where we have, say, multiple users. So say there are many senders and many receivers. They interact via a single quantum channel that applies correlated noise to their communications, and we'd like to know what are the rates at which these guys can communicate. So a simple example of this is a broadcast channel. You know, I'm broadcasting to you right now. So the idea is that you have one sender, many receivers, perhaps different noise levels, and you'd like to know what are the sets of rates that you can achieve with high fidelity, the communication rates you can achieve with high fidelity. Okay, as I mentioned at the start, actually, the things we do know about quantum capacities, we can sort of evaluate quantum capacities in some cases, but actually finding explicit constructions for these is still somewhat open. There are questions of coding theory and fault tolerance that I haven't mentioned. A really nice set of questions are the pure state source coding questions. So if you look at, source coding is like data compression. And actually, if you restrict your attention to pure states and you're interested in source coding, the problem is basically completely solved. It's sort of one of the unique examples of that. Of course, you might be interested in capacities of a quantum channel when you're assisted by two-way classical communication, so LOCC. And those are actually much more complicated than these unassisted capacities I've been talking about. I think several people mentioned this PPT criterion and NPT bound entanglement. I should point out that in general, even though it's true for degradable channels, the private and quantum capacities are the same, they can be rather different. So there are examples of channels with zero quantum capacity, but a tremendous amount of private capacity. Okay. I think I'll leave it at that, and maybe if you have any questions, just please ask.